This is audio book of Leslie Flint, Voices in the Dark, in half-hour parts. Text can be followed in the PDF or text version. Word errors may be here, and there by subsequent reading errors. First edition, January 1, 1971. Flint was born in London in 1911 and reached the peak of his fame from the 1930s to the 1960s. He was famous for claiming to contact the spirits of dead celebrities, and would often record his sessions. He claimed his familiar, Mickey, was the spirit of a child who had been killed in 1910. Flint claimed to have seen his first spirit at the age of 7 when his dead uncle appeared to him in his home. He conducted his first séance at the age of 17. In his early life, he worked as a cinema usher and a cemetery gardener. Flint was a conscientious objector in World War II, serving in the non-combatant corps before being seconded to coal mining. The first public séance performed by Flint was in 1955, just after he formed an association called the Temple of Light. Flint was an avid fan of Rudolph Valentino and acquired the only known copy of footage from the young Raja. Flint was wealthy and lived in a mansion house at Westbourne Terrace near London Paddington Station. The mansion had been formerly occupied by the actor George Arliss. During pre-production for the 1973 film, Don't Look Now, director Nicholas Roeg and actress Julie Christie were invited by Flint to a séance he was holding for some American parapsychologists who were coming to observe him. Roeg and Christie attended and sat in a circle in the pitch dark and joined hands. Flint instructed his guests to uncross their legs, which Roeg subsequently incorporated into the film. Style of mediumship. When taking part in séances with Flint, participants would report hearing the voices of the dead surrounding them in the room. Flint would perform bound and gagged in an attempt to prove that he was not throwing his voice. He claimed that he was able to conjure ectoplasm from which he could then reconstruct vocal cords. However, Flint always insisted on performing in the dark, so séance-goers were unable to see him during the performances. He would sometimes even perform in a cupboard, the spiritual mechanisms behind the phenomena for which Leslie was used as a tool are logically explained in the book written by Johannes Greber, almost 100 years ago and which in English is called Communication with the Spirit World. Foreword. Leslie Flint came into this world in 1911 and left it the 16th of April 1994. While here, he became the finely timed instrument transmitting thousands of messages from the world he now inhabits. No intellectual, but a plain-speaking man, Leslie was born into poverty and raised amid family disarray. Yet through dogged determination and single-mindedness, he became one of the most celebrated independent direct voice mediums of the 20th century. Through his remarkable gifts, he brought consolation and hope to the bereaved and understanding and inspiration to thousands, as well as shedding light on many strange corners of history. Voices in the Dark was first published in 1971. Thanks to the Leslie Flint Educational Trust, this new edition is presented to the public. The Trust has been established to preserve, record and authenticate Leslie's life work with its wide educational endeavors. Fortunately, today the public is, in part, more open and receptive to the reality of the spirit world, more understanding of the crucial link between this world and the next in the endless chain of human life. With the advent of Mickey, his much-loved Cockney alter ego in the world beyond, there began decades of service as a direct voice medium. Leslie gave sittings to those of every rank and degree, every profession, enabling the bereaved to learn of the great truth of human survival beyond physical death. His mediumship was also a channel for famous men and women whose spirit communications were on an elevated and inspiring plane, often throwing fascinating new light on the accepted annals of history. Skeptics attended sittings, but left convinced. Others tested Leslie's genuineness in every way. Truly, he could comment, "I am the most tested medium this country has ever produced." People traveled from all over the world to sit with him. Leslie also demonstrated abroad, particularly in the United States, where he was in great demand. The final chapter of his life came with his retirement to Hove, where he enjoyed years of peace and happiness before passing on at the age of 83. Leslie acknowledged he had no education to speak of, yet words of the highest wisdom and most profound knowledge, often in a variety of languages, emerged at sittings. He was an upright, simple man, with little financial ambition or perception, but his service to mankind was of inestimable worth. I have read letters written to him from many lands, expressing not only gratitude and friendship, but also love and affection. In the 16 years I knew him, from 1978 until his death, as both friend and professional advisor, I was struck by his simplicity of soul, his sheer innocence of material matters, and his honesty and integrity in his chosen career. While much of the world sinks further into a morass of materialism, commercialism and tribalism, it is now more important than ever that mankind learns to appreciate the spirit world's reality, the survival of the soul, the vital importance of good deeds and good thoughts to prepare the way ahead, and that, whatever color or creed, we are all spiritual beings expressed in physical terms. Leslie Flint displayed a rare dedication to his calling as a significant avenue linking two worlds. With this reprint of his own story, we salute him as one of the most outstanding mediums and dedicated servants of the 20th century. Mr. Aubrey Rose. 1. In spite of a childhood which would give any modern child psychiatrist nightmares, or perhaps because of it, I have reached the age of 59 without falling prey to neurosis, psychosis or even the screaming meanies. I am a happy man. I have friends who delight me, hobbies to absorb me, and I find satisfaction and fulfillment in my work. I do my work by sitting wide awake in total darkness with other people. I am a medium. I have the rare gift known as the independent, direct voice. I do not speak in trance. I need no trumpets or other paraphernalia. The voices of the dead speak directly to their friends or relatives and are located in space a little above my head and slightly to one side of me. They are objective voices which my sitters can record on their own tape recorders to play later in the privacy of their homes. Sometimes those who speak from beyond the grave achieve only a whisper, hoarse and strained, at other times they speak clearly and fluently in voices recognizably their own during life. And even after 35 years of my mediumship, I do not fully understand what are the conditions which cause the phenomena to vary in this way. I do know I have learned more about life and people and human problems and emotions by sitting in the dark than I could possibly have learned in any other way, and those who have taught me the most are people who, dead to this world, are living in the next. It seems to me that having entered my 60th year, it is time to set down on paper the story of my strange talent and the life it has led me, and where better to begin than at the beginning. My mother was much too beautiful for her own good, and she loved pleasure and admiration, so no one in the dingy street where she lived with her widowed mother in St. Albans was very surprised when she left her job in a local factory and disappeared from her usual haunts. No doubt they charitably assumed the worst, and in this case they were perfectly right. And I was born in a Salvation Army home in Hackney. My mother refused to have me adopted and, with a great deal more courage than she would need in the same circumstances today, went home to St. Albans with her inconvenient bundle to face the neighbor's music. But with a lot of help from my grandmother, fate had been working at her loom, as the saying goes, and between them my grandmother and fate came up with a pretty disastrous pattern. Instead of the recriminations and ostracism my mother expected, she found my father waiting with an offer of marriage and a home in a furnished room. Forthwith my arrival into the world was made legal, official and reasonably respectable. Their marriage was doomed from the beginning. They were pitifully young, desperately poor, and they had been coerced into maturity by their elders, long before they were ready for it. My mother, who loved gaiety and bright lights, pretty clothes and the admiration of men, found herself trapped in a seedy room with a baby who cried endlessly and a husband who drank most of his wages and put the rest on horses which never seemed to win. But somehow they survived 3 years of discord, fighting each other every inch of the way until the 1914-18 war broke out. I was 3 years old. My father was one of the first men in St. Albans to volunteer for the army, not, I imagine, from any fervent patriotism, but simply to get away from the domestic hell he lived in. My mother accepted her husband's departure for France with composure and, after arranging with her mother to take care of me during the day, she got a job in a local factory making munitions and life began again for her. She had her army allotment, she was earning money in the factory and St. Albans was full of men on leave, about to return to the trenches, who were only too pleased to take my pretty mother out and give her the gaiety she craved. One of my very early memories, vivid to this day, is of waking up in the dark to find I was alone in the room which was our home and feeling scared, lonely and desperately frightened that my mother had gone away like my father and neither of them would ever come back. Somehow, I dressed myself in the dark and wandered out of the house. I still remember standing in the pitch-dark street in the rain, calling and calling for my mother, but there was no one to listen and I sat down on a neighbor's doorstep and fell asleep. When my mother eventually came home she found me sitting in front of the neighbor's I diuresis negation replace drinking hot milk. When she got me back to our room she spanked me soundly for showing her up in front of the people next door. As it turned out, that night of desolation was the prelude to a period of bliss. My mother realized she could not again leave me alone in our room while she went out enjoying herself, without inviting interference from the neighbors. She had no intention, however, of giving up her freedom and so she concocted a plan. Every evening as soon as she was dressed to go out, she would take me by the hand to the local cinema where she would hand me over to Mrs. Knight, the wife of the manager, who for 3 or 4 pence would put me in a seat where she could keep an eye on me, and there I would stay until the cinema closed and my mother came to collect me. I was not old enough to take in a great deal of the many films I saw, but those nights at the pictures delighted me. I loved the thrill which rippled through the audience as the lights went out, the excited feeling that something wonderful was about to happen. When the I diuresis negation LM actually started, rustling and fidgeting would abruptly stop and all eyes were glued to the flickering figures on the screen. I loved the mood music which the pianist played on the upright piano. I came to recognize love music, angry music and the exciting hurry-hurry music when the hero or his sweetheart were in some dire predicament. I loved every minute of these nights at the cinema. But this halcyon interlude came to an abrupt end when my mother eloped with one of her admirers and disappeared from my life. I was collected from our room by my grandmother and taken to live with her in her two-up, two-down cottage in the poor street of terrace houses, where she existed rather than lived on a few shillings a week. The cost of feeding an extra mouth was really beyond her, but my grandmother knew her duty when she saw it, and even if it meant cutting her own living to the bare bone, she was determined to do her duty by her abandoned grandson. My grandmother could not read or write and she had strong principles which she taught me with a leathery hand if she thought it necessary. She worked very hard and I never knew her to sit still. She would spend the whole day at the big tub in the kitchen doing not only our own washing, but laundry she took in from the neighbors to earn a few extra pence. If the weather was fine, Gran would hang the washing in the yard to dry, but in the winter months every Monday morning she would string lines across the kitchen which was also our living room and damp sheets, shirts and towels flapped in our faces for 2 days, until they were dry enough to be pressed with the heavy rotation. The extra pennies she earned in this way helped to support us. We also had a lodger who paid a few shillings for his bed and board, and without his contribution to our budget I doubt if we could have existed at all. I suppose it is hard for members of our affluent society to imagine poverty as wretched as ours, but in those days a grown man might earn a wage of 12 shillings and 6 pence for a week's work and a married man might bring up his family on £1 a week. Gran and I had occasional luxuries. I remember being given 4 pennies to run to the corner shop to buy tuppence worth of broken biscuits and tuppence worth of jam. Coal was a luxury often out of reach, and in the autumn Gran would borrow a battered old pram from a neighbor and we would go wooding in the countryside around St. Albans to collect fuel to store for the winter. We spent many afternoons doing this because our old terrace cottage was cold and damp in winter and we had no money for illness. I can see my grandmother now sitting by a wood-eyed Ieris's negation re-backed up with soot from the chimney to make it last longer, mending, patching and darning, and myself sitting at her feet reveling in the warmth of the Ieris's negation re. Even if the clothes we wore were old and shabby, mended and patched, they were always clean, cared for and respectable. Respectability was terribly important to the working class in those days and when Gran went out, though her clothes were even then old-fashioned, indeed they were Victorian in style, she always looked neat and tidy. My grandmother had enormous influence on me and since she had a strict moral and ethical code I was brought up according to her own high ideals of what was right and what was wrong, though without any formal religious observance, because Gran would have thought it disrespectful to enter God's house in her shabby clothes and she was self-conscious about her illiteracy which made it impossible for her to follow the service. But when I was small she sent me to Sunday school and I wore a Sunday suit and a clean collar and my face was scrubbed and my hair brushed flat with water. The Sunday suit would be returned the next morning to the pawn shop where it remained most of the week in return for a couple of shillings to buy food, but at the Sunday school I was clean, neat and respectable. I liked Sunday school, especially in the winter months because it was warm and I enjoyed listening to the Bible stories and learning about heaven and hell and how dead people would rise from their graves to be judged when the angel Gabriel blew his silver trumpet on the last day and I accepted all I heard as the literal truth. One day I discovered that a small boy in the class attended three entirely different Sunday schools and this intrigued me. Did they all have different gods? What kind of stories did the other teachers tell? But it was simpler than that. By attending three Sunday schools, this enterprising child qualified for three Christmas treats. Now the Christmas treat was the biggest and most thrilling event in my whole year. There was a Christmas tree decorated in what, to me, was a breathtakingly beautiful fashion and every child got a toy from its laden branches. Then there was a magic lantern show followed by a glorious feast of jam sandwiches, iced buns and cakes, with lemonade to drink. Finally, when we went home we were presented with an orange and a balloon. I thought the boy was terribly clever to achieve three such brilliant occasions in one year. Timidly, I asked if I could copy, and graciously he said I could. And so for a whole year, unknown to Gran, my friend and I went to three different Sunday schools on alternate Sundays and duly earned three Christmas treats. Privately gloating over three toys, three oranges, three balloons, not to mention the memory of three parties, I felt vaguely sinful but quite determined to repeat the maneuver the following year. It was about this time, in the summer of 1918, that I had what I understand now to be my first psychic experience. I vividly remember being in our kitchen with Gran when my Aunt Nell came in and flopped into a chair, crying. Her husband had been killed in France and she was followed into the kitchen by a soldier carrying a kit bag containing Uncle Alf's possessions. But behind the soldier with the kit bag walked another soldier who stood in our kitchen looking lost and sad and he was pulling at Aunt Nell's sleeve, trying to attract her attention. Aunt Nell took no notice of him at all and shortly he just vanished. Later when Aunt Nell showed me a photograph of Uncle Alf I recognized him as the sad-looking soldier who was trying to make Aunt Nell pay attention to him, but when I told her about it both she and my grandmother were angry with me for telling lies. When I persisted in saying it was the truth I got a good wallop from Gran. Another time, as I came in from school I heard voices from the kitchen, Gran's voice and that of a woman unknown to me. When I went into the kitchen my grandmother was not talking at all, she was sitting in her wicker chair sewing, but standing at her side was an elderly woman with a large mole on her chin, who vanished as I came into the room. When I asked Gran what had happened to the lady who had been talking to her she told me I was imagining things, she had been quite alone all afternoon. I described the woman I had seen and when I mentioned the mole on her chin I got walloped again because, it's Mrs. Pugh you're talking about and she has been dead and buried for a month or more. After that episode, I learned to keep quiet about the people I saw who vanished so abruptly. I was not one of the giant intellects at school, but in one subject I shone quite brightly, and this was art. I loved drawing and painting, and I liked Mr. Lewis, the art teacher. He was a tall, gaunt man, I suppose in his late 40s, and he had been badly gassed in the trenches so that he coughed continually with a hard hacking sound. Mr. Lewis used to praise my efforts and encourage me to aspire to an art school training when I was older. Even then I knew we were too poor for this to be anything but an impossible dream, but his encouragement and praise meant a great deal to me, and I remember the red letter days when we would pin up my work for the rest of the school to admire. Eventually, I suppose, I came to look on him as a sort of father figure in my life. Probably because my own father had remained in its sobriety diaresis negation why. I can remember to this day the grief and shock I felt when Mr. Lewis died after an illness lasting a few days. It was some small comfort to learn that he was to be honored by a military funeral, because his death was due to his service in the trenches, and 12 boys from the school were going to be chosen to follow the coffin draped with the Union Jack. As I had been one of his best pupils and he had taken so much interest in my work, it simply did not occur to me that I would not be chosen to follow his coffin to the cemetery, but I was passed over, and my grief for his death was made the more bitter. When I was 12, I found a job I could do in the mornings before I went to school. It was in a house in what I thought of as the posh part of St. Albans. It was a well-furnished house and they had carpets, so I thought they must be very rich. I got up at 6 every morning and walked to work whistling happily at the thought of actually earning money, and for an hour and a half I cleaned the grates and lit the diaresis negation res and did other domestic chores. Then I hurried home to gobble down whatever was on offer for breakfast, usually bread and margarine and tea, and then went off to school. When my grandmother qualified for her old age pension of 10 shillings a week, our finances took on a brighter hue, but every Friday morning became a nightmare for me. Gran could only draw her pension on Friday, and by the time in the week she was penniless, but she had to have it in the morning to buy food for the weekend. Now, because she could not write her name, she would make a cross on her pension form, and an arrangement was made with the postmaster of the sub-post office across the road from our house, whereby he honored her cross and handed her 10 shillings to me. But the post office did not open until 9 o'clock, at which time I was due in school, so every Friday morning I had to hang about outside the post office waiting for the postmaster to open up to give me the 10 shillings, knowing with every minute which passed I was going to be late for school again. As soon as I got the 10 shillings, I would rush across the road and give Gran her money, then I would run all the way to school. But every Friday morning, without fail, I was late for class, and since Gran could not write an excuse note for me, as often as not, I was caned. In fact, it became a ritual. At 9:30 every Friday I was knocking timidly on the door of the headmaster's study, and at 9:25 I was being caned. I was not the bravest boy in the school, but however hard the headmaster laid into me with the cane each Friday morning, I never let out the smallest whimper, and all because of a picture hanging on the wall of his study. It was a painting of Queen Boadicea in her chariot, and for some reason it gave me courage. I felt Boadicea and I had something in common, and I must be as brave as she had been to be worthy of her. When I stood outside the headmaster's door on a Friday morning, it comforted me to think I would see her again, even if it meant I was going to be caned. I would try to be caned on the hand rather than on the bottom, even though it hurt more, so that I could stand facing her picture while the headmaster wielded his stick. For a long time I believed my picture was the real Queen Boadicea, and when I learned it was an impostor I was shattered. Some years before I was born, St. Albans had staged a pageant of its history, and one of the set pieces in it had been the uprising of Boadicea against the Romans. My picture was a portrait of the woman who had played the part of my heroine, and she had been chosen for the role because she was the wife of the local milkman and was able to commandeer his milk float for her chariot. As soon as I knew the absurd truth, the picture lost its magic, and when the headmaster next laid into me with the cane I wept. It simply did not occur to me to tell my grandmother about these weekly beatings. In those days, children hadn't the habit of complaining and their elders hadn't the habit of listening to them if they did. One of the maxims drilled into me as a child was, "What cannot be cured must be endured." My grandmother was a wonderful woman. She gave me all she could from the little she had, but her life was too harsh, the daily struggle for a bare existence too grim and too unrelenting for any tenderness between us. Our improved finances now made it possible for Gran and me to taste pleasure. For 3 pence or 4 pence each, we would go to the local cinema and escape for a couple of hours into an enchanted world where all the women were beautiful and the men were godlike. The films we saw were silent films, and I would read out the subtitles to my grandmother. Perhaps the absence of the spoken word stimulated the imagination more strongly, but audiences in those days identified wholly and completely with the stars they idolized, and they watched their films as if they were seeing real people living real lives. How we rejoiced or suffered with the heroine, how we urged on the hero or warned him of the machinations of the villain, usually greeted with hisses. In the hungry 20s, the working class was not as sophisticated or as educated as its modern counterpart. There were millions who could neither read nor write and who lived in squalid poverty. The cinema brought romance, glamour and excitement into their lives, and even if the intellectuals called it the opium of the masses, at least it was a relatively harmless drug and retailed at a price even the poorest could occasionally afford. My grandmother and I saw all the great stars, and the pictures were our delight and joy. At least once a week we would buy 4 penny tickets to our enchanted world and sit, eyes glued to the screen, transported. We also followed the serials, and if at the end of an episode Pearl White was left bound hand and foot in the path of an express train, we could hardly wait for the next episode to see if she would be saved. Deep down we knew very well she was bound to be rescued, but that did not stop us from living on tenterhooks for a week. About this time St. Albans got its first super cinema, and there was to be a gala opening with a showing of The Four Horsemen of the Apocalypse starring Rudolph Valentino. Seats for this glamorous event were expensive, and anyway they were all taken by the rich and privileged folk of the town, but at the last moment we heard that a few cheap seats would be available for those who queued on the great night. Naturally Gran and I arrived at the cinema hours before time and queued for these precious seats. We stood in line for 3 hours while the long queue shuffled forward inch by inch, but at last we got inside and sat down triumphantly in 2 plush seats in the very front row of the auditorium. The long wait and the seats which cricked our necks and made our eyes ache because they were so close to the screen did not matter to us one bit once the eidiasis negation LM had started. We adored every minute of it, and we thought Rudolph Valentino was the most marvelous actor we had ever seen. From then on we were his devoted fans. The sub-post office across the street from us was a kind of forum for the exchange of news, gossip, and above all, information about jobs, especially about jobs. Those were the days when work was pitifully scarce, and for every vacancy there were literally dozens of applicants. Even the rumor of work was enough to send desperate men trudging miles in the hope of being taken on at any wage, under any conditions, just so they could feed their families and regain their self-respect. One day, not long after my 13th birthday, the postmaster from across the street told me that the local cemetery wanted a strong, willing lad to work as the assistant to the gardeners. Though I was hardly carried away by the thought of working among graves, I made up my mind to try for the job, and if I got it I would leave school and begin my working life. I did get it, and so my formal education came to an end and I started work in the cemetery at 12 shillings and 6 pence a week. My work consisted of keeping graves neat and tidy, clipping grass verges, weeding and rolling gravel paths with a heavy iron roller. I also helped to dig new graves, and after a funeral I had to fill them in again. It was hard, back-breaking labor, but it was a job. I was earning my keep. I remember one cold and blustery day in winter when I was working on my graves and clipping the grass verges. We were waiting for a hearse to arrive with a funeral party. We, that is the other gardeners and I, had been busy all morning digging the grave for this burial, and after some months of working in the cemetery I knew from experience that the length of the funeral service would depend on the age of the clergyman who turned up with the hearse.